My name is John Malkin, and this is Transformation Highway. You're listening to KZSC Santa Cruz, 88.1 FM, KZSC.org, broadcasting from the University of California, Santa Cruz. Earlier this week, we celebrated Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and often this time of year, I like to rebroadcast my interview with Yolanda King, the daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. This interview was originally broadcast on Free Radio Santa Cruz in 2003. You'll hear Yolanda discuss the efforts she made to establish MLK Day as an official holiday. She also talks about nonviolence and spirituality and the U.S. government surveillance that her family endured for generations due to their social political activism. Yolanda King passed away in 2007. She was an activist, author, actress, and at the time of this interview, she just co-authored a book with Elodia Tate titled Open My Eyes, Open My Soul. Here now is Martin Luther King Jr.'s daughter, Yolanda King. You recently compiled a book of poems and stories with Elodia Tate, Open My Eyes, Open My Soul, and the book emphasizes the common qualities and unity that all human beings share. One of the poems, Human Family, by Maya Angelou, says, "We are more alike, my friends, than unalike." Often, though, governments and media emphasize our political, religious, or cultural differences and focus on conflict and violence rather than cooperation and love. How can we create a more peaceful world when we are being taught that violence is entertaining and when our political leaders advocate punishment and hatred?
Well, I certainly think that initiatives such as the one that Elodia Tate and myself have undertaken are necessary and imperative. In fact, any initiative that can help us to really embrace, first of all, become more aware of our oneness, and then embrace it. What I really love about this particular collection of stories and poems is that it really speaks to people from where they really are. These are moments in people's lives that are very special and eye-opening, moments that were really, really precious to them. And that comes through on the page. There are experiences that I think the reader can relate to. Many readers can relate to, because it really chronicles experiences that happen to everyday people, as well as obviously some special kinds of things, so that people can see from the inside out various people going through the incredible and important connecting with someone else or connecting with others, can really see that connection taking place and how the workings of it. And so it's not just a preachy kind of book, but you get a chance to actually feel those connections being made, people really coming out of themselves and opening up their hearts, their souls, their eyes to another way, a better way. And so I certainly advocate, obviously, these kinds of initiatives as an artist, and that's where my focus is. I really see myself as an artist communicator. I am always attempting to find creative ways to change people's hearts, to really affect people's hearts and minds. While it's imperative, I believe, obviously, to challenge the forces that would keep people from being able to live the fullest life, the forces that prevent people from being the very best that they can be, the forces that prevent people from living a decent life. We have to, in order to do that, we have to really affect people's hearts and minds. I think that's where the struggle is now, today is to change hearts. And so this book is about doing that, and this focus is about doing that.
Hmm. One of the components of doing that seems to be nonviolence, nonviolence towards self and towards others. And in my view, it seems that nonviolence is often misunderstood as a weak or soft strategy. Yet people like Mohandas Gandhi and your father, Martin Luther King Jr., said that nonviolent action required great courage. What do you think about this, and how is nonviolence applicable to our modern world?
Oh, absolutely. You know, a lot of people think nonviolence, when they think of it, they really see it as a sort of a wet dish rag behavior, a form of masochism to some extent, you know, going around smiling all the time and saying, hello, have a good day, when in fact you are angry inside. And that's not nonviolence. That really is masochism. Mm. But the kind of nonviolence that Gandhi practiced and lived, that my father believed in and lived, is really, it requires even more courage, I think, than what is very easy, which is to respond in a violent, in a very destructive way. That is the easy choice. That is the almost effortless choice. That is the choice that doesn't require much thinking. It's just total react. Whereas with nonviolence, you really, it's always been interesting to me that people say, well, it's passive because you're turning the other cheek. And I said, yes, but you're turning the other cheek and you're showing your best side. And that takes an incredible amount of courage and discipline. And I think that's the reason why it's been difficult for humanity to embrace, because it is the... it is the more courageous way to go, and but it is at the absolute and most incredibly rewarding when one is able to really reach that level of living and being and interacting. It is an incredible liberation and freedom.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what your thoughts are about the current global justice and anti-war movements and the role of nonviolence as a strategy in those movements. Recently, millions of people worldwide engaged in nonviolent protests against another U.S. war on Iraq, and it seemed that the bombing might be stopped. But in fact, the United States military did attack Iraq and is now occupying that country. How well do you think the global peace movement is incorporating nonviolence in their struggle?
Well, I was really thrilled to see the utilization of nonviolent strategy, tactics, of a really nonviolent way of responding to the military assault, the threat, and then the actual carrying out of that threat of military involvement. I think it was so important, even though it did not change the course of what actually happened, but I think it was so important for people, for the powers that be, as well as the people who were involved, even more so, to take that kind of stand, to involve themselves in that kind of movement and that kind of initiative. It reminds me so much of a story that a man who is told about a man who for many years would go out and demonstrate in front of a nuclear arms facility, and many times he was by himself. Sometimes there were a few other people with him. Sometimes they would arrest him. Most times they just left him alone. And somebody asked him at a point, you know, why do you keep doing this? It's so futile. I mean, you're not changing a thing. And he said, well, perhaps I may not change the world, but I'm going to make sure that the world doesn't change me. And I think that's really what I was so thrilled to see, because I felt that people refused to just give in to a sense of powerlessness and said, there's something we can do to say, we don't care for this. We choose to make another choice, regardless of what you do. We're going another way. We're making another choice. And I was very encouraged by it.
Mm. Yolanda, I'm curious about your views on the role of spirituality in social change. Many people seem to feel that they need to choose between spiritual growth or social change. And your father, Martin Luther King Jr., and many others have intertwined these aspects. What role do you think spirituality plays in social change? And maybe what role do you think it played in the civil rights movement of the 1950s and 60s in the United States?
Well, it really went hand in hand. With the civil rights movement, there could not have been, I don't believe, the success that was realized, nor the tenaciousness with which so many people came together to move our country to a more sensible, a more embracing, a more inclusive way of being. It would not have occurred if people were not fueled by a tremendous spiritual force and energy, tremendous amount of I believe spiritual power was just was really the undergirding of the civil rights movement. I mean, my father, needless to say, often talked about the fact that while Gandhi provided the methodology, the nonviolent methodology, it was Jesus Christ who really showed the way. And it was that focus, it was that the way of refusing to, first of all, believing that you had the power within, and that you were, that what we were fighting for, what we were striving for, was something that was really God-ordained, that came from the very foundations of the creation of us as humanity. It was that sort of belief, that philosophy that undergirded and really served as fuel for the movement and for so many who participated. And so it was a wonderful coming together, and I think integration of spiritualism and social change and really kind of melding the political with the spiritual. It needs to happen today. It's unfortunately not happening as much as it should. It seems to me that there are people more than I would care to see it. There are people in different camps who are saying, well, this is the way you have to be in order to kind of preserve the purity of whatever the spiritual journey may be. And then you have, of course, the others who are totally, completely activists for change. And it's important, I think, to bring the two together. I think that's when we will again see the kind of tremendous growth, the tremendous progress, the tremendous leap that took place. As difficult as it was, I'm not denying that it was not a very challenging time, but there was a tremendous leap that we made in the 60s as a result of that melding of faith and the quest for change. Mm.
It seems indeed that it was a very difficult struggle, that nonviolence isn't necessarily the easy path. And your father was threatened many, many times and imprisoned, And on April 4th, 1968, he was killed. And you were 12 years old then. It is widely believed that his assassination was part of the counterintelligence program of the FBI and other departments of the United States government. I would like to hear about the history of U.S. government surveillance and interference in your family's political and religious activities and your thoughts about who killed your father, Martin Luther King Jr.
Ironically enough, we have found, and there has been evidence that has revealed that as far back as my great-grandfather, my father's grandfather, surveillance by the government was taking place. I mean, this was in the 20s when my grandfather, great-grandfather, who was very much involved in the local political scene in Atlanta at the time, very much at that time, needless to say, it was quite quite courageous to take a stand, even particularly for some of the issues that he was championing, and there have been some documents that have revealed that indeed during his lifetime in the 20s and 30s that there was actual surveillance going on by the military. And then my grandfather, my father's father, also experienced very similar kinds of experience, and while it was not as widespread as it became with my father, it just kind of continued. And of course, with my father's very direct involvement, it really escalated tremendously. We are convinced that it was because of the efforts that and initiatives that my father was taking in the last couple of years of his life, his stand against the war in Vietnam, his work to bring together poor people across racial lines, that it was perceived as a threat. A very direct threat to the American peace, to domestic peace at home, and because so much of the military resources were being poured into, or the defense resources were being poured into the Vietnam War, there was a real fear in among a number of paranoid governmental officials that if indeed anything happened domestically, that there would be no way to contain it, and that Martin Luther King Jr. was could very well be responsible for things getting out of hand because of the work that he was doing. The last 6 months of his life, you may be aware, he was crisscrossing the country, bringing together, meeting and organizing, bringing together Native Americans, working on reservations with Native American organizations, and working in the barrios with Latino and Hispanic organizations, working in Appalachia with poor whites, really bringing all of us together, helping us to understand the common problems, the economic injustices. And that was huge. That potential coming together, I think, was perceived as an incredibly threatening alliance, and it's very much the reason why he had to be stopped.
Hmm. And 15 years after your father was killed, Ronald Reagan, President of the United States at the time, signed a bill to create a national holiday commemorating Martin Luther King and his work for peace and justice. Tell me, you were at the signing of that bill by President Reagan. Tell me about that, and also tell me about the effort it took to create this commemorative holiday.
Yes, I call the signing of the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday bill by President Ronald Reagan, it's one of the miracles of the 20th century. The fact that this man, who clearly disliked my father and did not believe in many of the initiatives, many of the policies, many of the principles and ideals for which my father was working toward, did not honor them, at least, well, some of them, I guess, publicly he might have embraced, but clearly had many philosophical differences with him. The fact that he signed this bill it boggles the mind sometimes. But it just shows that, as my father always said, that that truth crushed the earth will rise again. That no matter what, you know, you cannot stop what is truth and what is right. And when I look back on it now, it seems rather that it was not an extraordinary the events and the activity and all of the work that went into bringing the holiday into being. It seems now that it really was not a major, just not a huge major thing, because when you think back on some of how long it's taken to accomplish really important, significant occurrences in the history of the world, it only took about 10 years for the holiday to get momentum and then take off. And it took another 5 years, so it was about 15 years from beginning to end to bring the holiday into being. A lot of work and a lot of time and a lot of effort and energy from both people in government to grassroots organizing, to Stevie Wonder, to the just the incredible lobbying efforts of my mother and others, an incredible amount of energy went into it. But when you stop and think about it, it was only 15 years, and for something as totally significant and really, I mean, it was a precedent. It set such a tremendous precedent that I don't think will ever be surpassed, really. I mean, my father currently is the only American that has a holiday, because now Washington and Lincoln's birthdays have now been combined into President's Day. And so it's truly extraordinary. And I do remember very well the day, because we went into the Oval Office and after we had all greeted President Reagan, we all stood there sort of in this frozen moment of time. Nobody quite knew what to say. He certainly didn't know what to say. It was clear that he was really uncomfortable and sort of just stood there waiting for a cue or waiting for a script or waiting for a line. And sure enough, George Bush finally, after my mother broke the ice by announcing, "What a great day." And George Bush was the person who responded, not Mr. Reagan, but Mr. Bush was the person who said, "Yes, it is." And he sort of took it from there. And In fact, Mr. Reagan said very little during the course of the time we were there. And then we left and went out onto the lawn, and he delivered his speech, and he convinced even me that he loved Martin Luther King Jr. he was quite an actor. That's when I got to see it firsthand, that he was quite the communicator, that's for sure.
Academy Award performance.
Oh,
maybe.
Yes.
Yolanda King, in September 2003, you were a featured speaker at a World Peace Conference and 50th birthday celebration for the Indian guru Sri Amartinandamai Devi, also known as Amma. You told a stadium full of people that women need to rise up as women, not as imitations of men. Tell me more about this idea that women need to rise up as women, not as imitations of men.
I think all too often, because these are the models that we have as women begin to move and assume positions of power, there's a tendency to emulate the role models, that the only role models that we have had, which are men. And all too often, it ends up, we end up utilizing the same tactics, the same kind of oftentimes hurtful or harsh and not compassionate tactics, tactics that lack compassion and that don't necessarily, I think, convey what women, the very unique qualities that women bring to the table in our rush to either climb the ladder or break through the glass ceiling or to be accepted at the table as equals. And it's imperative that we hold on to those things, those qualities that do make us special and make us unique. I mean, the fact that we are more feeling people is, I think, of value. It is not something to be thrown out. It is something that is really important, that the intuition, the sense of compassion, of caring, of nurturing, that is so much a part of the feminine aspect is so vitally needed in the political sphere, in the corporate arena. That's what's needed, I think. In fact, if there had been more of that in the history of the world and the making and the creation of our societies, I think if there had been more feminine influence, then we'd have a very different world than we do today. And so I just think it's imperative. I was so pleased to be a part of Amma's 50th birthday celebration, because it not only was a tribute to her, which was so well deserved, but the bringing together of women and men, people from so many different backgrounds, really trying to fashion policies and real action steps that would allow people to take a leap forward and be able to hopefully contribute to changing some of the patterns that have existed and the tendency for men only to carry the ball. It is time for women to come to the table and really to bring our very unique and very significant perspective.
Mm. Yolanda King, I would like to ask you just one more question. I'm grateful for having the opportunity to speak with you. I am curious about the role that you think creativity has in social change. You have chosen to be an actor and a creative person in your work. And in particular, you've portrayed Rosa Parks in a television movie. And I think that a lot of people don't know that she had training in nonviolent direct action before her courageous refusal to move to the back of the bus. I wonder if you could tell me about the role of creativity and also a little about Rosa Parks.
Yes, Mrs. Parks had been involved prior to that very fateful day when she refused to give up her seat. She had been involved with the NAACP, organizing in the Montgomery, Alabama community, had attended some workshops on nonviolent direct action, and she certainly was someone who cared. I mean, she was already an activist to some extent in her life, not by any means to the extent that she became after that day. Her involvement grew tremendously, because I think that particular day was one of those, my father calls it zeitgeist moments, where everything, the forces of time and history and who she was as an individual, just all kind of came together. There was no more perfect person than Rosa Parks to serve as the spark that ignited the civil rights movement, because she, in her very being, was such an embodiment of nonviolence. She was a gentle spirit, just naturally, not something that she learned. That's just who she is, and at the same time, had a passion and a fire inside. It was you know, kind of a quiet fire, and the fact that I call her a quiet giant. You know, it's just that she was the person who sparked. I think that is not coincidental. She was the absolute right person, and I think that's the reason why the community responded in the way they did, because she was, first of all, very respected in the community, but also because she was such a gentle soul, I think people were outraged by the fact that someone like herself would have to suffer that kind of indignity, and it really served to bring the community together in a way that it had not been able to do so before. I mean, there had been other people who had been arrested, you know, on the buses for doing the similar kind of thing. But it was because of Mrs. Park's spirit and who she was that that really just galvanized people. And then obviously Martin Luther King Jr. was in the right place at the right time. And was able to, it was that act that propelled him into leadership. The creative force is so, I believe, has so much power and so much potency to really change and alter people's thinking, people's hearts and minds. And that's why I choose to utilize the creative expressions. Well, I don't know if I chose it. I feel like it chose me, actually. Mm-hmm. That this is how my purpose and mission on the planet, how it has come forth and borne fruit. And it makes perfect sense to me, because I think that it is that part of us, the creative part of us, that has the ability to change and to grow and to experience and to really transform, and that's what I've sought to do in my work, as both as an actor and as a speaker and as an author, as a teacher, as a producer, to really try to utilize the creative energy to transform people's thinking and hopefully, ultimately, their lives.
Yolanda King, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you. I have enjoyed it very much. You're listening to KZSC Santa Cruz, 88.1 FM, kzsc.org. You've been listening to an interview with Yolanda King, daughter of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. You can listen to Transformation Highway every Thursday at noon California time on KZSC 88.1 FM or kzsc.org.